You probably know the feeling of pins and needles, a numbing, tingling sensation that can be pretty unpleasant, but probably short-lived, unless you happen to be one of the millions of Americans who suffer from something known as tingling and numbing paresthesia. It's a chronic and fairly common condition in which the uncomfortable prickling feeling doesn't go away and even becomes debilitating. Researchers do not fully understand what causes this constant tingling or how best to treat it, but as Ike Sriskandaraja reports, a possible key to the mystery lies in an unexpected place.
Mission Chinese in San Francisco is a restaurant, not a science lab. But I'm here because of a science researcher. Diana Bautista is at the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at UC Berkeley and an expert on our sense of touch.
A lot of what we know has come from studying interesting plants that give us unique sensations.
How we experience the heat of a chili pepper, for instance, or the coolness of a mint leaf. So, when Bautista decided to investigate what goes on inside nerve cells when we get a tingling, numbing sensation, she turned to the berries of the prickly ash tree, better known in Chinese cooking as the Sichuan peppercorn. It's famous for the strong, vibrating buzz it makes in your mouth. Jesse Coity, head chef at Mission Chinese, brings a taste.
Okay, so I just wanted to bring these out. These are the three forms of Sichuan peppercorn ingredients that we use.
My friends and volunteer taste testers, Sabrina Ramos, Chris Edley, and Steve Backer, eyeball the three small plates of spice. There are pea-sized red peppercorns, green peppercorns, and an oil super-infused with ground Sichuan peppercorns.
Should I put multiple? The oil is going to be very scary. I'm nervous.
When I visited her lab, Diana Bautista had told me what to expect.
You get sort of a wave of different sensations. First, I experienced a light citrus flavor.
It's very flowery.
And then you start to feel a little bit of a prickling sensation.
Well, it starts to get tingly.
It just hit the tip of my tongue like a burst.
And at its apparent apex.
And then when you think that it's ending, it's actually just about to start.
Wow.
Oh, I feel the buzz.
Oh, yeah. Oh, now I'm really kicking.
Now, what Bautista, who's a neuroscientist, wanted to know was, why do we feel this mouth buzz from eating a bowl of spicy mapo tofu? Is the Sichuan pepper activating the same nerve cells that respond, say, when your cell phone buzzes or you use an electric toothbrush? It's a tricky question, because there are 30 different kinds of nerve cells called somatosensory neurons, and they each respond to different tactile sensations. So how do you figure it out?
You could look in the microscope.
In her lab, I'm staring into a dish full of somatosensory neurons taken from a mouse.
It's a mixed population of cells that includes touch, itch, and pain neurons, all 30 types together.
Bautista says one day she took a mixed bunch of cells like these and exposed them all to an extract called sanchul, the active ingredient that gives Sichuan pepper its buzz. That's how she made the discovery. Most of the cells did nothing, but one type did respond, the big ones.
So the big ones are the ones that are sensitive to light, touch, and vibration?
Sichuan pepper was activating the very same type of cells that let you feel your phone vibrating.
And so we were really excited, and it is the first compound that specifically targets the touch pathway.
But that's not all. Not only does Sichuan pepper chemically mimic touch,
it turns out that Sichuan peppers activate the same neurons that are affected in patients who suffer from tingling and numbing paresthesia.
Which was a real find. For one thing, it finally gives scientists a way to study in the lab all the chemical and electrical steps that lead to the brain getting the message when your foot falls asleep. Researchers can now take touch cells, get them buzzing using the pepper extract, and then start to figure out exactly what's going on at the molecular level, which might suggest ways of switching off the buzzing in patients who live with this tingling, numbing sensation all the time. And researchers have been using Bautista's finding in other ways, too. I came across a paper in the British journal Proceedings of the Royal Academy, wonderfully titled Food Vibrations. It was written by Nobuhiro Hagura, a neuroscientist at University College London, who wanted to know whether everyone experiences those peppery vibrations in the same way, like we all hear the same note in music.
The bottom line is very simple. We wanted to know what is the frequency perceived by Sichuan pepper, and is it consistent across participants?
He designed a neat experiment. 28 willing volunteers came to his lab, and instead of giving them some spicy Sichuan takeout, they each got enough sanchul extract to make their mouths tingle. Each of them also got a small box that could vibrate, a bit like a cell phone. You can sort of imagine the scene. The task for the tingling volunteers was to try to match the peppery vibrations in their mouths to the vibrations they could feel in their fingertips as the researchers dialed the frequency of the box up or down.
And they're closing their eyes and they're saying higher or lower. So it's a kind of a bizarre situation.
Until the Sichuan buzz and the mechanical buzz converged on the same frequency, which turns out to be 50 hertz. That's the sound of how the Sichuan pepper tastes. Scientists are still looking for other plants that could help unlock the secrets of our sensory nerves. And who knows, maybe there's a whole somatosensory symphony just waiting to be heard. For NPR News, I'm Ike Sriskandaraja.
The man we'll meet next managed to write an entire cookbook about a single ingredient. Food writer Michael Ruhlman found plenty to say about the, well, take a listen.
You can cook it in its shell or out of its shell. If you cook it in its shell, you can hard boil it, soft boil it. If you take it out of its shell, you can poach it, fry it, deep fry it, bake it. You can blend it and then cook it in other different ways. And then if you want to separate it, you can do different things with the white and with the yolk.
His book is called Egg, and he read from it with our colleague Steve Inskeep.
In the kitchen, the egg is ultimately neither ingredient nor finished dish, but rather a singularity with a thousand ends. Scrambled eggs and angel food cake and ice cream and aioli and popovers and gougères and macaroons and a gin fizz aren't separate entities. They're all part of the egg continuum. They are all one thing. The egg is a lens through which to view the entire craft of cooking. By working our way through the egg, we become powerful cooks. Mm.
The egg is a lens through which to view the entire craft of cooking, which is your craft. Use that lens for us. If we just follow the egg through the kitchen and its uses through the kitchen, what will we learn about your craft?
Well, we learn how to make a creamy custard with both egg white and yolk alone. We'd learn how it enriches. When you bake an egg, you see how the egg works on its own and with other ingredients. So again, when you know all the properties of the egg and all the ways it works, you become a more accomplished, powerful, competent cook.
Okay, and I'm just going through here. There's the potato, onion, and cheese frittata. I guess that's the key to the egg, is what you might add to the egg here and there.
Well, that's the thing. The egg then becomes the unifier of all these ingredients. You make basically a custard, and you pour it over all these other delicious ingredients, which soak them up, and the egg combines them and makes them one, makes them whole.
Here's a picture of a seafood dish, scallops and crab, seafood roulade. What does the egg do there?
The egg white is used there as a binder to hold everything together and to give it a smooth texture.
You even go into the matter of scrambled eggs and argue that there's a way to do them right and a way to do them wrong, and we very, very often do it wrong, and it's a crime.
It's one of the most overcooked dishes in America. We kill our eggs with heat. In most instances, gentle heat is what the egg loves. And when you cook them very slowly over very gentle heat, the curds form, and as you stir, the rest of the egg sort of warms but doesn't fully cook and becomes sort of a sauce for the curds. So it should be a creamy and delicious and delicate preparation.
Do we overdo it because of fear?
We overdo it because of lack of knowledge, and some people are afraid of their eggs. I've never gotten sick from an egg that I know of.
Meaning people just don't know how to make an egg.
Well, again, we're taught in many ways to fear our food, and I think it does a great disservice to the people who want to cook their own food. So I want people to cook, but how are they going to cook if they're taught to be afraid of an egg?
One other vital question here. How normally do you crack an egg?
Gosh, I watched André Soldre, the wonderful French chef of Lutèce, crack an egg, and it never left me. And he just tapped it gently on a flat surface, and then he gently just pulled the egg apart. And I love the gentleness of the way he handled an egg, and I always think about that when I crack an egg.
So that short-order cook thing of whacking the egg on the edge of the pot and throwing it in, that might look impressive, but that's not the way to handle an egg.
It's not the best way, but sometimes it's what's called for.
Michael Ruhlman, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here, Steve. Thanks.
He is the author of Egg, a culinary exploration of the world's most versatile ingredient.
If you are an observant Christian, then you know that Holy Week begins this weekend with Palm Sunday and concludes next week with Easter Sunday. Those days commemorate the defining moments of the faith. Now, Christians celebrate in all kinds of ways, including with a visit from the Easter Bunny, but a big part of the celebration is that big holiday dinner, emphasis on big. In this country, it's usually ham or lamb and maybe potato salad or scalloped potatoes. And that got us thinking again about why we eat what we eat. And maybe if you aren't a fan of all that heavy meat, what should you do? So we called Frederick Douglass Opie. He is a food historian at Babson College, and he writes the blog Food as a Lens. Welcome back, Professor Opie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also joining us once again, Bryant Terry. He's author of the new book Afro-Vegan, Farm Fresh African, Caribbean, and Southern Flavors Remixed. Welcome back to you, Mr. Terry.
Thank you for having me on, Michelle.
So, Professor Opie, let me start with you. We asked our listeners to tweet us what's on their tables this year. I just want to read a couple. Lauren Davis wrote, hopefully ham and deviled eggs will be on the menu. Also, someone in our family usually picks up Easter bread loaves in Philly. Here's another one. Listener Franny Nelson tweeted, fried turkey, mac and cheese, greens, rolls, pound cake, lemon bars, and whoopie pies. Now, I don't know how I forgot the deviled eggs in my intro, but it seems that those traditional Easter dishes like deviled eggs, potato salad, all involve like, you know, eggs, cream. Is that true? Are there Easter kind of must-haves, or is this very regional, very personal, very family?
I think it's regional. They're definitely must-haves. They're required to get into the household in many situations. You know, you mentioned from one of the people who contributed to the tweets, whoopie pies. As soon as you said that, I said they're from New England. That's a Boston area kind of dish that, you know, or dessert that I've never heard of. But there's regional differences, but they are rich foods. They're the times of the year where people splurge in their diet, and historically splurging may be, you know, using flours, white flour, or sugar, or dairy products. That's all part of the splurge, in addition to the reader that talked about, or the tweeter that talked about ham. Those are all examples historically of splurging at the table.
Bryant Terry, another listener, Patty Lee, tweeted, trying to get healthier so deviled eggs will be guacamole style. That's where you stuff the egg whites with guacamole instead of the filling made with egg yolk. I don't know if she's got anybody following her down that road, but do you hear from a lot of people who are looking for some alternatives to those heavy foods that a lot of us grew up with?
You know, I do hear from a number of people who are looking for both lighter foods and more plant-centered foods to bring to the tables during the holidays. And I'm always happy to, you know, provide my recipes, point people in a different direction for those type of recipes. And I think it's important, as Fred mentioned, the holidays are typically times of celebration where people do give themselves more room to splurge a little bit. And, you know, for me, having a healthful diet most of the time actually allows one to indulge during the holiday and special occasions and not feel any guilt. So, you know, I think it's nice to have those plant-based options. And I think it's also about just thinking about how we can maintain a healthful diet most of the time.
Well, you were saying, though, that this, maybe people think that eating vegan sounds new agey, but you're telling us, and you've told us before, that you're actually bringing back old traditions. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and you know, I like to talk about plant-strong diets, because when I think about my ancestors growing up in Memphis and rural Mississippi, you know, the type of meals that we ate every day, the type of things we got harvested from our gardens and our farms were just simple, nutrient-rich foods like collard greens, mustards, kale, turnips, dandelions, butter beans, black-eyed peas, the type of foods I think any allopathic Western physician would say that most people should eat for a healthful diet. And so I simply want to help people remember that our foods are bigger than the comfort foods, and to say that, you know, we have traditions of eating farm-to-table.
Well, these days, Professor Opie, you can understand why something like asparagus is something that is a spring vegetable. So that's why, you know, it would make an appearance on the Easter table, because this is the kind of thing that is only available, traditionally only available in the spring. So you would want to enjoy it when it's available. But are there other foods that are particularly associated with Easter, and do they have any specific meanings?
I would say that collard greens, kale, or any of those type of greens are going to be at the table at an Easter meal. And they are representative of some of the first things that will come out of the ground as it becomes warm enough to return to the garden. You know, as you all were discussing this whole idea of the plant-based diet, I thought that maybe this would be almost like if you looked at a Star Wars movie and it said, you know, remember the Force, this would be return to the source. That is, return to the ground where you can then you know, raise those type of things that, you know, most of the winter, historically speaking, you're eating out of a can. And you can't wait to get to that Easter table. You have something freshly grown that you can consume.
So, Brian, you know, we've all talked about how food is fuel, but it's also feeling. Can you recommend some dishes that people might want to consider that gives them those kind of feelings that they're used to in consuming those traditional foods at Easter time that might, you know, just give us some different alternatives?
Well, as Fred was just mentioning,
I don't want anybody causing ruckus because we're trying to take away their mac and cheese. Okay, I'm just trying to. I'm trying to keep things quiet here, but just, you know, give us some ideas.
And you know, and I always say that when we think about including more, you know, plants. Strong foods in our diet. It's not about rejecting those older traditions. If people have that nostalgia and, you know, those comfort foods, whether it's chitlins or neck bones or macaroni and cheese and a lot of those foods, I get it. And I don't think we should reject those wholly, but I think we need to think about including or re-including many of the older foods. And so, you know, we're talking about the spring. You know, one of the things that I emphasize is eating seasonal vegetables and seasonal ingredients, because we can make a lot of arguments, but one of the things that makes the most sense is it's most flavorful. When you're harvesting things straight from the ground that are in season and that are local, they're going to taste so much fresher and delicious than things that have been sitting in trucks or refrigerators for weeks on end. And so I have this all-green spring slaw in Afro-Vegan, in which it's kind of a modern take on the traditional coleslaw, but really it's just a cabbage-based salad in which we use green peas and sugar snap peas and you know, celery and pumpkin seeds and parsley and chives. So really taking advantage of many of the, you know, just the things that are heralding spring, these fresh green vegetables, and it's light.
And how do you get your
delicious
dressing? So you got the green cabbage, you got the green peas, sugar snap peas, celery, pumpkin seeds, flat leaf parsley, the chives. How do you get, and some grated limes? And so how do you get that the dressing to bind it? What do you do for that?
I don't want to scare anyone off with this, but the dressing is actually a tofu based dressing. And so traditionally, you know, a lot of vegetarian and vegan cuisine, silken tofu is used for desserts and dressing. So it's a really buttery, soft tofu that you know, you can blend with a little olive oil, whatever herbs and spices. And so it replaces the mayonnaise that one might see in the kind of ubiquitous drowned in mayonnaise potato salads or
see,
know,
now I'm detecting a little bit of a bias there, a little bit of a bias, but we'll try to move past it there.
But you know, the funny thing, when I go to family meetings, unlike family food gatherings around food, unlike when I was in high school when I first became a vegan and I was proselytizing and, you know, haranguing people about why they need to be a vegan, I just bring the dish without any meat or anything and put it on the table. And it's interesting. Usually those dishes are gone before the other stuff that's drowned in mayonnaise and drowned in meat. So I let the flavor do the talking.
What about for the traditional, like the mustard greens or the greens that people have, and they're used to using some kind of meat to give it a more, to flavor it? What do you recommend for that?
Slow food cooking, really taking our time doing things like, you know, sauteing the onions in olive oil until they're, you know, crisp and golden and actually starting to caramelize and bringing out a lot of the natural sugar, adding some of the, you know, garlic, maybe adding a number of herbs and spices to punch up the flavor. And, you know, I find that those things give dishes as much flavor and as much depth as one might get by throwing a piece of fat back in. You know, that stuff is easy and I get it. And I'm not like saying using rendered fat is like, I'm not totally against that if people choose to do that, but that's easy. Like, let's take some time and do some slow food cooking in the kitchen with the family.
I'll be giving you my address later so that you can demonstrate, you know, up, you know, so. All right, Professor Obi, final thought from you is that you are a proponent of, like Mr. Terry here, of making sure that people kind of connect the food with the feelings and the ideas that are important. So what is there something you would like us to be thinking about as we plan our Easter menus, those of us who observe this?
Mm-hmm. I just got out of a class, teaching a class, and one of the things I tell them is for those who are observing Easter, when you get home and you see the food on the table, ask the relatives what best represents our family on this table. Because if you look at that dish and you find out that recipe, it'll give you a better clue of your family's cultural roots than anything else. So that's one of the things I'd like to do, is have people to not only enjoy consuming the food, but enjoy talking about the food and what it teaches you about your own family's history.
Frederick Douglass Opie is an historian at Babson College. He blogs at Food as a Lens. He was with us from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Bryant Terry is author of the new cookbook, Afro-Vegan. He joined us from San Francisco. Thank you both so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lucky Santangelo is a household name in a lot of those households which house some of the more than 500 million copies sold of the novels of Jackie Collins. Ms. Santangelo, as we put it here on NPR, is the heroine, more or less, of seven of them, including Lucky, Vendetta, Lucky's Revenge, Dangerous Kiss, Drop Dead Beautiful, and Goddess of Vengeance. She's kind of all those things, the beautiful daughter of a former mob boss who has her own way of making offers that people can't refuse, including the food, which is lavishly prepared for the people that Lucky Santangelo cherishes, unless, of course, they get in her way. Jackie Collins has now produced the Lucky Santangelo Cookbook. What a wonderful excuse to talk to Jackie Collins, who joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Scott.
Well, let me begin with a recipe I wasn't expecting, which is meatloaf.
Ah, yes, well,
and you, and you say in this book, you eat meatloaf.
I love meatloaf.
Why am I surprised by that?
I don't know. Meatloaf, fabulous mashed potatoes. But my favorite recipe in the book of all is something that my mother taught me, and that's the English roast potatoes.
Oh, no. I saw that one, and they're...
You got to try those. You will love those. You parboil them for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you have hot oil in your oven. And you take out the hot oil and you throw the potatoes in and you just leave them for an hour and they will come out fabulously crisp on the outside and fabulously soft on the inside.
I think children will appreciate your approach to vegetables in this cookbook, which is just cheese them up. You know, it's a pretty simple recipe, if I say so myself. Tell us about cheesy cauliflower au gratin.
Oh, well, that is absolutely delicious. I mean, you just cover everything in this fabulous cheese and you melt it and you make the vegetables very kind of edible, you know, because most kids are used to vegetables that they get at school and they're disgusting, you know, and so they go off vegetables. But if you can introduce...
Overcooked, limp, lifeless.
Yeah, exactly. Pale. Didn't you get that at school? I know I did.
Yes,
and so if I'm going to do vegetables, then I want them to be absolutely delicious and delectable.
You did a lot of movies like your sister, Joan Collins. What made you move into writing?
Well, actually, I was always an out-of-work writer, and I only did movies when I was a teenager, and I was expelled from school. And my parents said to me, oh, you know, your sister's doing movies in Hollywood. She's a big star out there. You can go and do the same thing. You're not bad-looking. And I thought, well, I'll make some money making these movies, playing the Italian girl, which is what I always seem to be cast as. And I did it for, you know, a couple of years when I was a teenager. I had to throw Alec Guinness over my shoulder in one movie and played the Italian girl in another. And
Wait. You threw Alec Guinness over your shoulder?
Well, we were doing this movie called Barnacle Bill, and he was supposed to rock and roll with me. And, you know, he was a much older man. And
how did you, forgive me, you threw one of the great men of the English theater over your shoulder.
There was a whole bunch of us that were rock and roll teenagers in the scene, and I was the one that was elected to dance with him in my tight jeans and my striped T-shirt, and I have the stills to prove it.
My.
And then I said, this is ridiculous. I have to start on my writing career. So I wrote a book called The World is Full of Married Men. Because I found that in my teenage years, married men would be chasing me everywhere and going, oh, yeah, well, my wife is different, but, you know, she doesn't really understand me. And I thought, this is so interesting. And I wanted to write and turn the double standard on its head. And then eventually I created Lucky Santangelo because she is such a brilliant character because she does all the things that women would like to do. She says all the things they would like to say, and she gets away with it.
Another recipe.
Yes.
Lemon linguine, which is reportedly a Santangelo family favorite.
It is a family favorite, and they love it with the creamy sauce.
This is essentially lemon zest with a lot of cream and butter over linguine.
I know. It's terrible the way I use cream and butter, but I think if you're going to indulge yourself, you may as well indulge, you know? And that's what the family does. I do think you can treat yourself. And I believe in chocolate. Like, there's some great chocolate desserts, the molten chocolate and the pies and things like that.
The chocolate mousse with creme fraiche.
Oh, great. Don't you love creme fraiche? So I have used a lot of things in the book that probably are forbidden in most books because I look on the bestseller list and I see how to be healthy, how to eat healthy, how to do this and how to do that. But what the hell? You know, we're only here once. Let's have some fun.
Jackie Collins, her new book, The Lucky Santangelo Cookbook. Good eating to you, Ms. Collins.
Well, thank you.